welcome to the Book Report in what will be our most shocking show to date.
Why?
The subject is banned books. Last month, I had Donna Seaman, a member of the American Library Association, on my show as a guest. In the course of our discussion, she brought up the subject of banned books. I was stunned. In 2012, are there still banned book lists? Yes, there are. And this, dear readers, happens to be the 30th anniversary of Banned Books Week, September 30th to October 6th, 2012. Banned Books Week brings together the entire book community, librarians, booksellers, publishers, journalists, teachers, and readers of all types, in shared support of the freedom to seek and to express ideas, even though some consider unorthodox or unpopular. As a real eye-opener, check the list of banned classics on the American Library Association or the ALA.org website. I did, and oh boy, one unbelievable example, To Kill a Mockingbird, has been continually targeted. To list just a few of its challenges, in 1980, it was challenged in a New York school district as, quote, a filthy, trashy novel. In 1981, it was challenged at an Indiana school district with claims the book did, quote, psychological damage to the positive integration process and represents institutionalized racism under the guise of good literature, unquote. And as recently as 2009, it was removed from classrooms in Canada, Ontario District, because a parent objected to language used in the novel. Want more? According to the Huffington Post, the Merriam-Webster Dictionary was banned in a California elementary school in January 2010 for its definition of oral sex. Quote, it's just not age-appropriate, a district representative said. The Diary of Anne Frank has been banned on multiple occasions. Most recently, in January 2010, the book was pulled from a Virginia school for sexually explicit and homosexual themes. Okay, what book were they reading? By focusing on efforts across the country to remove or restrict access to books, Banned Books Week draws national attention to the harms of censorship. You can get involved. For the second year in a row, readers can participate in the Banned Books Virtual Readout, where you can declare your freedom to read by uploading videos of yourself reading from your favorite banned or challenged books. You'll find lists of banned books and much more information on bbw@ala.org. So, readers, today we'll explore books and authors who frequently make the banned list. Ready to be outraged? Let's turn to page one of the book report. Come to Miami for the warm winter weather and for the 29th Miami Book Fair International, where Tom Wolfe, Juno Diaz, Lemony Snicket, Sandra Cisneros, and more than 300 authors from around the world will read from their books, answer questions, and autograph their books. All at the nation's largest book fair, 29th Miami Book Fair International, November 11 through 18. Information at miamibookfair.com. Perks of Being a Wallflower by Stephen Chbosky made it on the banned books list. I bet you're looking forward to seeing the new movie. Yep, time for the book report to preview it. Most people think 15-year-old Charlie is a freak. But then, seniors Patrick and his stepsister Sam take Charlie under their wing and introduce him to their eclectic, open-minded, hard-partying friends. It's from these older kids that Charlie learns to live and love. More intimate than a diary, Charlie's letters are singular and unique, hilarious and devastating. We may not know where he lives or to whom he is writing, but we know the world he shares. This is a poignant tale of a boy caught between trying to live his life and trying to run from it. Noah Galvin performs a deeply affecting story that takes you back to those wild roller coaster days known as growing up.
The counselor said that he suspected that Michael had problems at home and didn't feel like he had anyone to talk to. That's maybe why he felt all alone and killed himself. Then, I started screaming at the guidance counselor that Michael could have talked to me, and I started crying even harder. He tried to calm me down by saying that he meant an adult, like a teacher or a guidance counselor, but it didn't work, and eventually, my brother came by the middle school in his Camaro to pick me up. For the rest of the school year, the teachers treated me different and gave me better grades, even though I didn't get any smarter. To tell you the truth, I think I made them all nervous. Michael's funeral was strange because his father didn't cry, and 3 months later, he left Michael's mom. At least, according to Dave at lunchtime. I think about it sometimes. I wonder what went on in Michael's house around dinner and TV shows. Michael never left a note, or at least his parents didn't let anyone see it. Maybe it was problems at home. I wish I knew. It might make me miss him more clearly. It might have made sad sense. One thing I do know is that it makes me wonder if I have problems at home. But it seems to me that a lot of other people have it a lot worse. Like when my sister's first boyfriend started going around with another girl, and my sister cried for the whole weekend. My dad said, "There are other people who have it a lot worse." And my mom was quiet, and that was that. A month later, my sister met another boy and started playing happy records again. And my dad kept working, and my mom kept sweeping, and my brother kept fixing his Camaro. That is, until he left for college at the beginning of the summer. He's playing football for Penn State, but he needed the summer to get his grades right to play football. I don't think that there is a favorite kid in our family. There are three of us, and I am the youngest. My brother is the oldest. He is a very good football player and likes his car. My sister is very pretty and mean to boys, and she is in the middle. I get straight A's now, like my sister, and that is why they leave me alone. My mom cries a lot during TV programs. My dad works a lot and is an honest man. My Aunt Helen used to say that my dad was going to be too proud to have a midlife crisis. It took me until around now to understand what she meant by that, because he just turned 40 and nothing has changed. My Aunt Helen was my favorite person in the whole world. She was my mom's sister. She got straight A's when she was a teenager, and she used to give me books to read. My father said that the books were a little too old for me, but I liked them, so he just shrugged and let me read. My Aunt Helen lived with the family for the last few years of her life because something very bad happened to her. Nobody would tell me what happened then, even though I always wanted to know. When I was around 7, I stopped asking about it because I kept asking like kids always do, and my Aunt Helen started crying very hard. That's when my dad slapped me, saying, "You're hurting your Aunt Helen's feelings." I didn't want to do that, so I stopped. Aunt Helen told my father not to hit me in front of her ever again, and my father said that this was his house, and he would do what he wanted, and my mom was quiet, and so were my brother and sister. I don't remember much more than that because I started crying really hard, and after a while my dad had my mom take me to my room. It wasn't until much later that my mom had a few glasses of white wine and told me what happened to her sister. Some people really do have it a lot worse than I do. They really do.
We've just heard The Perks of Being a Wallflower by Stephen Chbosky. New York Times best-selling author Jodi Picoult is widely acclaimed for her keen insights into the hearts and minds of real people. My Sister's Keeper, a star of the banned books list, tells the emotionally riveting story of a family falling apart by conflicting needs and a passionate love that triumphs over human weakness. Anna is not sick, but she might as well be. By age 13, she has undergone countless surgeries, transfusions, and shots so that her older sister, Kate, can somehow fight the leukemia that has plagued her since childhood. Like most teenagers, Anna is beginning to question who she truly is. But unlike most teenagers, she has always been defined in terms of her sister. And so Anna makes a decision that for most would be unthinkable, a decision that will tear her family apart. Is it morally correct to do whatever it takes to save a child's life, even if that means infringing upon the rights of another? Is it worth trying to discover who you really are, if that quest makes you like yourself less? Should you follow your own heart or let others lead you? This title won an Audie Award for a multi-voice performance. Let's listen to a sample.
Now that I am 13, these distinctions are only more complicated. The eighth grader who dropped out of school because she got into trouble. A neighbor who got herself pregnant in the hopes it would keep her husband from filing for divorce. I'm telling you, if aliens landed on Earth today and took a good hard look at why babies get born, they'd conclude that most people have children by accident, or because they drink too much on a certain night, or because birth control isn't 100%, or for a thousand other reasons that really aren't very flattering. On the other hand, I was born for a very specific purpose. I wasn't the result of a cheap bottle of wine or a full moon or the heat of the moment. I was born because a scientist managed to hook up my mother's eggs and my father's sperm to create a specific combination of precious genetic material. In fact, when Jesse told me how babies get made and I, the great disbeliever, decided to ask my parents the truth, I got more than I bargained for. They sat me down and told me all the usual stuff, of course, but they also explained that they chose little embryonic me, specifically because I could save my sister, Kate. We loved you even more, my mother made sure to say, because we knew exactly what we were getting. It made me wonder, though, what would have happened if Kate had been healthy? Chances are I'd still be floating up in heaven or wherever, waiting to be attached to a body to spend some time on Earth. Certainly, I would not be part of this family. See, unlike the rest of the free world, I didn't get here by accident. And if your parents have you for a reason, then that reason better exist. Because once it's gone, so are you. Pawn shops may be full of junk, but they're also a breeding ground for stories, if you ask me. Not that you did. What happened to make a person trade in the never-before-worn diamond solitaire? Who needed money so badly they'd sell a teddy bear missing an eye? As I walk up to the counter, I wonder if someone will look at the locket I'm about to give up and ask these same questions. The man at the cash register has a nose the shape of a turnip and eyes sunk so deep I can't imagine how he sees well enough to go about his business. Need something? He asks. It's all I can do not to turn around and walk out the door, pretend I've come in by mistake. The only thing that keeps me steady is knowing I am not the first person to stand in front of this counter, holding the one item in the world I never thought I'd part with. I have something to sell, I tell him. Am I supposed to guess what it is? Oh, swallowing. I pull the locket out of the pocket of my jeans. The heart falls on the glass counter in a pool of its own chain. It's 14-karat gold, I pitch. Hardly ever worn. This is a lie. Until this morning, I haven't taken it off in 7 years. My father gave it to me when I was 6 after the bone marrow harvest, because he said anyone who was giving her sister such a major present deserved one of her own. Seeing it there on the counter, my neck feels shivery and naked. The owner puts a loop up to his eye, which makes it seem almost normal size. I'll give you 20. Dollars? No, pesos. What do you think? It's worth 5 times that, I'm guessing. The owner shrugs. I'm not the one who needs the money. I pick up the locket, resigned to sealing the deal, and the strangest thing happens. My hand, it just clamps shut like the jaws of life. My face goes red with the effort to peel apart my fingers. It takes what seems like an hour for that locket to spill into the owner's outstretched palm. His eyes stay on my face, softer now. Tell them you lost it, he offers, advice tossed in for free. If Mr. Webster had decided to put the word freak in his dictionary, Anna Fitzgerald would be the best definition he could give. It's more than just the way I look, refugee skinny with absolutely no chest to speak of, hair the color of dirt, connect-the-dot freckles on my cheeks that, let me tell you, do not fade with lemon juice or sunscreen or even, sadly, sandpaper. No. God was obviously in some kind of mood on my birthday, because he added to this fabulous physical combination the bigger picture, the household into which I was born. My parents tried to make things normal, but that's a relative term. The truth is, I was never really a kid. To be honest, neither were Cade and Jesse. I guess maybe my brother had his moment in the sun for the 4 years he was alive before Kate got diagnosed, but ever since then, we've been too busy looking over our shoulders to run headlong into growing up. You know how most little kids think they're like cartoon characters? If an anvil drops on their heads, they can peel themselves off the sidewalk and keep going? Well, I never once believed that. How could I, when we practically set a place for death at the dinner table? Kate has acute promyelocytic leukemia. Actually, that's not quite true. Right now, she doesn't have it, but it's hibernating under her skin like a bear until it decides to roar again.
That was My Sister's Keeper by Jodi Picoult.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MagicBuzz.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
Readers, although her book is not on the banned books list, her subject, Louise Brooks, was as shocking and unconventional a woman as had ever been seen in her day. I had the great pleasure recently of speaking with Laura Moriarty, author of the bestseller, The Chaperone. Welcome, Laura. Thanks so much for stopping by the Book Report.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Well, congratulations on an amazing book. The Chaperone is everybody's talking about it. It's everywhere. When you were writing it, did you sense that this was going to be something really special?
You know, I hate to say I did. I did. As soon as I came up with the idea, I was just so in love with it and so excited about it. And I thought, if I can just do this right, I know there's a fabulous story in here.
All right. What about Louise Brooks intrigued you at first? Where was that kernel of an idea?
Well, you know, she's always so fascinating. She was beautiful. You know, even if your listeners don't know the name, they certainly know the face. She had the black bob and the blunt bangs. She was so beautiful. And, you know, her gorgeous shopping in a bookstore one day, and I learned she was from Kansas. I had no idea she grew up about 3 hours from where I did. She doesn't really seem like a Kansan, but she was. And she was very, very smart, well-read, cultured. She was also arrogant, condescending, difficult, funny, and a wonderful writer herself. So I thought that was pretty interesting. And then I learned that when she was 15 years old, there's just a couple lines in her biography. When she was 15 years old, she got into the Denison Dance School, where, you know, Martha Graham was, you know, this forerunner of modern dance. And so she got to go to New York City for 5 weeks in the summer of 1922, but because she was only 15, she brought along a 36-year-old chaperone. And, you know, the books don't say much about the chaperone, but I thought, oh my gosh, what would that have been like to come to New York City in 1922 with a young Louise Brooks who isn't yet famous, but who is already difficult, arrogant, condescending, smart, and gorgeous. So I decided to write a novel and find out.
I think you did a wonderful job in just, you know, very sparingly letting all the readers know how very bright Louise was.
Yeah, I hope so. I wanted to do her justice because she was incredibly intelligent. You know, she was reading the philosophy of Arthur Schopenhauer from an early age, and she was also such a snob. And so I wanted to get that across. You know, I don't know that I could have written it from her perspective, but I'm much more comfortable with Cora, who is intelligent and thoughtful, but, you know, she's just sort of a normal person. And here she is with this 15-year-old precocious genius who doesn't care about anything she says.
You know, I found some parallels. Maybe you've thought about this too, between Cora and Louise, in that Cora, of course, was an orphan. Louise had a mother who openly admitted she never wanted to have children. And they both took train journeys to become the next step in their lives. Cora heading west to become a part of a family. Louise heading east to, you know, discover her stardom.
Right, right. And, you know, I think in all my work, mothers and daughters are so fascinating to me, and how many different forms that relationship can take. And so I do find it interesting how their lives parallel in that way, and how they have so many differences. You know, as you say, Louise's mother was really a complicated person. She never wanted to have children, but then she goes and tells her children that, and she was known as the most beautiful woman in Wichita. You know, she was every bit as lovely as Louise, but because of circumstance, had a different life and felt often resentful of it.
How did you find out about the orphan trains? I'm a student of American history. I certainly have never heard of them.
You know, I wouldn't have known, except a few years ago, I was in our public library, and there was a big display about the orphan trains, which is of interest to people where I live in Lawrence, Kansas, because people are descended from these orphans. You know, most, I think almost all the orphan train riders now have passed or are dying or very old. And so a lot of work around here was done to get their stories, and documentary films have been made because so many of them, over 200,000 children, came here on the orphan trains between after the Civil War in 1929. Some of their stories are happy and some of their stories are tragic, and most of them are philosophical about it. You know, even the ones who didn't have the best situation when they arrived out here and were just adopted on the spot as soon as they got off the trains, you know, they said, well, at least I lived, which might not have happened in New York because the situation was so desperate with so many impoverished children.
200,000, that number is staggering.
Yeah. And it was all, you know, it was all done by Charles Loring Brace, who was a social worker, you know, and he really wanted the best for these children. And, you know, he probably saved lives, and he probably ended up destroying several lives.
Well, the audiobook is getting rave reviews, too. And talk about that and the very wonderful narrator.
Oh, I was so thrilled. You know, they said to me, well, we think we can get Elizabeth McGovern to read your novel. And I thought that was fabulous because I've always loved her. You know, I've loved all her film work. And then, of course, I'm addicted to Downton Abbey. And so I was just so happy to hear that she was going to be reading it. And then someone told me, well, she read it and she liked it enough that she optioned the film rights. And she wants to play Cora, which I think would just be fabulous.
Oh, and looking around, as writers sometimes do, who would you like to play Louise?
You know, that's what I wrote her, because Elizabeth McGovern sent me an email and I wrote back and I said, you're going to make a fabulous Cora. I don't know who you can find to play Louise. And I mean, I'm sure she's out there. I'm sure she's out there, but she has to be very young, gorgeous, and able to play such a smart, sassy, condescending, arrogant, gorgeous dancer, funny. I don't know who she is. I'm sure she's out there. It'll be interesting to see who they find, because, you know, there aren't so many Louise Brooks walking around.
True. So what's your next project, or have you even begun to think of that?
You know, I have. It's been difficult because I've loved this project so much. I was so caught up in it and so wrapped up in Cora and her story and the time period. But I am looking at historical fiction again because I just really loved sort of working the facts of history into a compelling story. I just loved that challenge, and I loved how it took me into another world and made me really consider what it was like to live in another time.
Okay. Readers, this is one fabulous read. It is a really eye-opening, well-written, smart, intriguing book. I urge you to pick it up. Thanks so much for stopping by today.
Thank you, Anne. Thank you.
Alrighty, bye. Now, let's listen to a sampling of The Chaperone, narrated by Elizabeth McGovern.
Lightning shot across the western sky, and though both women flinched, Cora, without thinking, smiled. She'd always loved these late spring storms. They came on so fast, rolling in from the prairie on expanding columns of clouds, a welcome release from the day's building heat. An hour before, when Cora and Viola were canvassing, the sun was hot in a blue sky. Now rain fell fast enough to slice green leaves from the big oak outside the library. The lilacs trembled and tossed.
"Don't you think she's a tiresome snob?"
Cora hesitated. She didn't like to gossip, but she could hardly count Myra Brooks as a friend. And they'd been to how many suffrage meetings together? Had marched together in the street? Yet if she passed Myra today on Douglas Avenue, Cora wouldn't get so much as a hello. Still, she never got the feeling that it was snobbery, as much as Myra simply not registering her existence, and there was a chance it was nothing personal. Myra Brooks didn't seem to look at anyone, Cora had noticed, not unless she was the one speaking, watching for the impression she made. And yet, of course, everyone looked at her. She was, perhaps, the most beautiful woman Cora had ever seen in person. She had pale skin, flawless, and large dark eyes, and then all that thick, dark hair. She was certainly a talented speaker. Her voice was never shrill, and her enunciations were clear. But everyone knew it was Myra's looks that had made her a particularly good spokeswoman for the movement, a nice antidote to the newspaper's idea of what a suffragist looked like. And you could tell she was intelligent, cultured. She was supposed to know everything about music, the works of all the famous composers. She certainly knew how to charm. Once, when she was at the podium, she'd looked down at Cora, right into her eyes, and smiled as if they were friends.
"I don't really know her," Cora said.
She looked back out through the blurred windshield at people ducking out from a streetcar, running for cover. Alan had taken a streetcar to work so she could have the Ford.
"Then I'll inform you, Myra Brooks is a tiresome snob."
Viola turned to Cora with a little smile, the ostrich plume grazing her chin.
"I'll give you the latest example. She just sent a note to the secretary of our club. Apparently, Madame Brooks is looking for someone to accompany one of her daughters to New York this summer. The older one, Louise, got into some prestigious dance school there, but she's only 15. Myra actually wants one of us to go with her. For over a month."
Viola seemed pleasantly outraged, her cheeks rosy, her eyes bright.
"I mean, really, I don't know what she's thinking, that we're the help? That one of us will be her Irish nanny?"
She frowned and shook her head.
"Most of us have progressive husbands, but I can't imagine any one of them would spare a wife for over a month so she could go to New York City, of all places. Myra herself is too busy to go. She has to lie around the house and play the piano."
Cora pursed her lips. "New York," She felt the old ache right away.
Well, I suppose she has other children to look after.
Oh, she does, but that's not it. She doesn't take care of them. They're motherless, those children. Poor Louise goes to Sunday school by herself. The instructor is Edward Vincent, and he picks her up and takes her home every Sunday. I heard that right from his wife. Myra and Leonard are alleged Presbyterians, but you never see them at church, do you? They're too sophisticated, you see. They don't make the other children go either.
That speaks well of the daughter, that she makes the effort to go on her own.
Cora cocked her head.
I wonder if I've ever seen her.
Louise, oh, you would remember. She didn't look like anyone else.
We've just heard The Chaperone by Laura Moriarty.
Social media. It's got everyone buzzing these days. But what is it really, and how can you put it to work for you? More than just a passing trend that's hot today, gone tomorrow, social media is marketing that is making a difference for savvy business people who have jumped into the future. Magic Buzz is a new online marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media like Facebook and Twitter together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. Magic Buzz's socio-viral solution provides the measurable value of online advertising that works, affordable, and effective. So get the buzz going for your business. Magic Buzz, with only one Z, because we're never asleep. Visit us at magicbuz.com. For more information or any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
Come to Miami for the warm winter weather and for the 29th Miami Book Fair International, where Tom Wolfe, Juno Diaz, Lemony Snicket, Sandra Cisneros, and more than 300 authors from around the world will read from their books, answer questions, and autograph their books. All at the nation's largest book fair, 29th Miami Book Fair International, November 11 through 18. Information at miamibookfair.com. Mi Ultima by Rodolfo Anaya has been called the most widely read Mexican-American novel in the English language. Yet, before researching this show, I had not heard of it. Time for the book report to investigate. This is a richly evocative story of a young man who, as he follows his own path to adulthood, relies on the wisdom of Ultima, a magical healer. The book has earned its place among the classics of modern literature. Why it is on the banned book list is baffling. Let's listen to the riveting and evocative narration of Robert Ramirez.
She couldn't see beauty in the llano, and she could not understand the coarse men who lived half their lifetimes on horseback. After I was born in Las Pasturas, she persuaded my father to leave the llano and bring her family to the town of Guadalupe, where she said there would be opportunity and school for us. The move lowered my father in the esteem of his compadres, the other vaqueros of the llano, who clung tenaciously to their way of life and freedom. There was no room to keep animals in town, so my father had to sell his small herd, but he would not sell his horse, so he gave it to a good friend, Benito Campos. But Campos could not keep the animal penned up, because somehow the horse was very close to the spirit of the man, and so the horse was allowed to roam free, and no vaquero on that llano would throw a lasso on that horse. It was as if someone had died, and they turned their gaze from the spirit that walked the earth. It hurt my father's pride. He saw less and less of his old compadres. He went to work on the highway, and on Saturdays, after they collected their pay, he drank with his crew at the Longhorn. But he was never close to the men of the town. Some weekends, the llaneros would come into town for supplies, and old amigos like Bonnie or Campos or the Gonzalez brothers would come by to visit. Then, my father's eyes lit up as they drank and talked of the old days and told the old stories. but when the western sun touched the clouds with orange and gold, the vaqueros got in their trucks and headed home. And my father was left to drink alone in the long night. Sunday morning he would get up very crudo and complain about having to go to early mass. She served the people all her life, and now the people are scattered, driven like tumbleweeds by the winds of war. The war sucks everything dry, my father said solemnly. It takes the young boys overseas, and their families move to California, where there is work. Ave Maria Purissima. My mother made the sign of the cross for my three brothers, who were away at war. Gabriel, she said to my father, it is not right that La Grande be alone in her old age. No, my father agreed. When I married you and went to the Llano to live with you and raise your family, I could not have survived without La Grande's help. Oh, those were hard years. Those were good years, my father countered. But my mother would not argue. There isn't a family she did not help, she continued. No road was too long for her to walk to its end to snatch somebody from the jaws of death. And not even the blizzards of the Llano could keep her from the appointed place where a baby was to be delivered. Es verdad, my father nodded. She tended me at the birth of my sons. And then I knew her eyes glanced briefly at my father. Gabriel, we cannot let her live her last days in loneliness. No, my father agreed. It is not the way of our people. It would be a great honor to provide a home for La Grande, my mother murmured. My mother called Ultima La Grande out of respect. It meant the woman was old and wise. I have already sent word with Campos that Ultima is to come and live with us, my father said with some satisfaction. He knew it would please my mother. I am grateful, my mother said tenderly. Perhaps we can repay a little of the kindness La Grande has given to so many. And the children? My father asked. I knew why he expressed concern for me and my sisters. It was because Ultima was a curandera, a woman who knew the herbs and remedies of the ancients, a miracle worker who could heal the sick.
That was Bless Me Ultima by Rodolfo Anaya. Cover Boy by Mark Matabane is the classic story of life in apartheid South Africa. The title was first published in the 80s and, as you might expect, was banned for a time in South Africa. Matabane was weaned on devastating poverty and schooled in the cruel streets of South Africa's most desperate ghetto, where bloody gang wars and midnight police raids were his rites of passage. Like every other child born in the hopelessness of apartheid, he learned to measure his life in days, not years. Yet, armed only with the courage of his family and hard-won education, Matabane raised himself up from the squalor and humiliation to win a scholarship to an American university. The author narrates.
This road passes through proclaimed Bantu locations. Any person who enters the location without a permit renders himself liable for prosecution for contravening the Bantu Urban Areas Consolidation Act 1945 and the Location Regulation Act of the City of Johannesburg. The above message can be found written on larger-than-life signs staked on every road leading into Alexandra, where I was born and raised, or for that matter, into any other black ghetto of South Africa. It is meant to dissuade white people from entering the black world. As a result, More than 90% of white South Africans go through a lifetime without seeing firsthand the inhuman conditions under which blacks have to survive. Yet, the white man of South Africa claims to the rest of the world that he knows what is good for black people and what it takes for a black child to grow up to adulthood. He vaunts aloud that his blacks in South Africa are well-fed and materially better off under the chains of apartheid than their liberated brothers and sisters in the rest of Africa. But in truth, these claims and boasts are hollow. The white man of South Africa certainly does not know me. He certainly does not know the conditions under which I was born and had to live for 18 years. So my story is intended to show him with words a world he would otherwise not see because of a sign and a conscience wrecked with guilt, and to make him feel what I felt when he contemptuously called me a Kaffir boy. At the writing of this book, the ghetto of Alexandra had just been saved from extinction by Bishop Desmond Tutu, winner of the 1984 Nobel Peace Prize, and a group of clergymen. When the reprieve came, over half of Alexandra had already been destroyed. For the ghetto had been on death row since 1962, when the South African government first decreed that it had to go because it occupied land onto which whites wished to expand. The remains of Alexandra can be found about 10 miles north of Johannesburg. You will not mistake those remains for anything else. They occupy a 1 square mile pit, constantly shrouded by a heavy blanket of smog. It is the only such pit in an enclave of spacious, fresh-aired, verdant white suburbs sporting such melodious names as Northcliff, Rosebank, Lower Houghton, Bramley, Killarney, and Edenvale. The Alexandra of my childhood and youth was a shanty town of mostly shacks, a few decent houses, lots of gutters, and lots of unpaved, potholed streets with numbers from 1st to 23rd. 1st Avenue was where Indians, the cream of Alexandra's quarantined society, lived, behind their sell-everything stores and produce stalls, which were the ghetto's main shopping centers. Indians first came to South Africa in 1860 as indentured servants to work the sugarcane fields of Natal. 2nd, 3rd, and 4th Avenues were inhabited mostly by coloureds, the mulatto race which came into being 9 months after white settlers arrived in South Africa in 1652, without women. The rest of Alexandra's streets were filled by black faces, many of them as black as coal, full-blooded Africans. Many of these blacks were as poor as church mice.
We've just heard Kaffir Boy by Mark Matabane. Come to Miami for the warm winter weather and for the 29th Miami Book Fair International, where Tom Wolfe, Juno Diaz, Lemony Snicket, Sandra Cisneros, and more than 300 authors from around the world will read from their books, answer questions, and autograph their books, all at the nation's largest book fair, 29th Miami Book Fair International, November 11 through 18. Information at miamibookfair.com.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. MagicBuzz.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
The books of Toni Morrison frequently appear on banned books list. Hard to believe, isn't it? Recently, we previewed Home, Morrison's newest title. Although the book was incredibly powerful, I found the author's narration painfully slow. Go to bookreportradio.com, archived shows for August 18th of this year, to hear the sample. This title, Tar Baby, is narrated by Desiree Coleman. As an FYI, actress Alfre Woodard narrates the abridged version. Ravishingly beautiful and emotionally incendiary, Tar Baby is Morrison's reinvention of a love story. Jadine Childs is a black fashion model with a white patron and a white boyfriend. Sun is a black fugitive who embodies everything she loathes and desires. As Morrison follows their affair, which plays out from the Caribbean to Manhattan and the Deep South, she charts the nuances of obligation and betrayal between blacks and whites, men and women.
Just as suddenly, the water lady removed her hand and the man swam toward the boat anchored in blue water and not the green. As he neared it, he circled. He heard nothing and saw no one. Moving port side, he made out Seabird 2 and a 3-foot rope ladder gently tapping the bow. He grabbed a rung and hoisted himself up and aboard. Panting lightly, he padded across the deck. There was no trace of the sun, and his canvas shoes were gone. He sidled along the deck, his back against the walls of the wheelhouse, and looked into its curved windows. No one was there, but he heard music from below and smelled food cooked with a heavy dose of curry. He made his way aft and cautiously descended a short flight of stairs. The music was louder there and the smell of curry stronger. The farthest door stood ajar, and from it came the light, the music, and the curry. Nearer to him were two closed doors. He chose the first. It opened into a dark closet. The man stepped into it and closed the door softly after him. Slowly, he moved his hand forward in the dark and felt nothing as far as his arm could reach. Moving it to the right, he touched a wall. He duck-waddled closer to it and sank to the floor, his back against the wall. He was determined to remain alert at all costs, but the water lady brushed his eyelids with her knuckles. He dropped into sleep like a rock. The engine did not wake him. He had slept with the noise of heavier ones for years. Nor did the boats list. Before the engines was the forgotten sound of a woman's voice. So new and welcoming it broke his dream life apart. He woke, thinking of a short street of yellow houses with white doors, which women opened wide and called out, "Come on in here. You, honey, you!" Their laughter sprawling like a quilt over the command. But nothing sprawled in this woman's voice. "I'm never lonely," it said. "Never." The man's scalp tingled. He licked his lips and tasted the salt caked in his mustache. "Never?" It was another woman's voice, lighter, half in doubt, half in awe. "Not at all," said the first woman. Her voice seemed warm on the inside, cold at the edges. Or was it the other way around? "I envy you," said the second voice, but it was farther away now, floating upward and accompanied by footsteps on stairs and the swish of cloth.
We've just heard Tar Baby by Toni Morrison. Stephen King is yet another frequent visitor to the banned books list. Among his banned titles are classics like Cujo, Carrie, and The Dead Zone. Another is Christine, which we'll preview now, and which Publishers Weekly has called, quote, some of the best writing King has done. From the moment 17-year-old Arnie Cunningham saw Christine, it was love at first sight. He knew he would do anything to possess her. But Christine is no lady. She is Stephen King's ultimate vehicle of terror. Holter Graham narrates.
It was Arnie's suggestion when we were 10 that we sneak out one night and put a load of dried horse apples from the Route 17 stables under the gross plastic horse on the lawn of the Libertyville Motel just over the line in Monroeville. Arnie knew about chess first. He knew about poker first. He showed me how to maximize my Scrabble score. On rainy days, right up until the time I fell in love, well, sort of. She was a cheerleader with a fantastic body, and I sure was in love with that. Although when Arnie pointed out that her mind had all the depth and resonance of a Sean Cassidy 45, I couldn't really tell him he was full of because he wasn't. It was Arnie I thought of first, because Arnie knew how to maximize rainy days, just like he knew how to maximize Scrabble scores. Maybe that's one of the ways you recognize really lonely people. They can always think of something neat to do on rainy days. You can always call them up. They're always home. Always. For my part, I taught him how to swim. I worked out with him and got him to eat his green vegetables so he could build up that scrawny bod a little. I got him a job on a road crew the year before our senior year at Libertyville High, and for that one, we both battled our butts off with his parents, who saw themselves as great friends of the farm workers in California and the steel workers in the burg, but who were horrified at the idea of their gifted son, top 5% on his Stanford-Binet, remember, getting his wrists dirty and his neck red. Then, near the end of that summer vacation, Arnie saw Christine for the first time and fell in love with her. I was with him that day. We were on our way home from work, and I would testify on the matter before the throne of Almighty God if called upon to do so. Brother, he fell, and he fell hard. It could have been funny if it hadn't been so sad, and if it hadn't gotten scary as quick as it did. It could have been funny if it hadn't been so bad. How bad was it? It was bad from the start, and it got worse. In a hurry. Part 1. Dennis. Teenage Car Songs. Chapter 1. First Views. Oh my God! My friend Arnie Cunningham cried out suddenly. What is it? I asked. His eyes were bulging from behind his steel-rimmed glasses. He had plastered one hand over his face so that his palm was partially cupping his mouth, and his neck could have been on ball bearings the way he was craning back over his shoulder. Stop the car, Dennis! Go back! What are you... Go back! I want to look at her again! Suddenly, I understood. Oh, man, forget it, I said. If you mean that thing we just passed, go back! He was almost screaming. I went back, thinking that it was maybe one of Arnie's subtle little jokes. But it wasn't. He was gone, lock, stock, and barrel. Arnie had fallen in love.
We've just heard Christine by Stephen King. One of the most important novels of the past 50 years, Slaughterhouse-Five, has been widely banned. This is a book about more than war. It's about time, perception, and the calamitous nature of mankind. Ethan Hawke's reading is superbly done, wonderfully capturing Vonnegut's absurdism. The preview we'll hear is Hawke reading Vonnegut's foreword to the book. A great treasure you'll hear on the audiobook is an interview with Vonnegut at the end. I bet, like me, you read this title in college. It's time to revisit it. Billy Pilgrim is a man who's become unstuck in time after he is abducted by aliens. In a plot-scrambling display of virtuosity, we follow Pilgrim simultaneously through all the phases of his life, concentrating on his shattering experience as an American prisoner of war who witnessed the firebombing of Dresden.
I'm reminded, too, of the song that goes, "My name is Jan Janssen. I work in Wisconsin. I work in a lumber mill there. The people I meet when I walk down the street, they say, 'What's your name?' And I say, 'My name is Jan Janssen. I work in Wisconsin.'" And so on to infinity. Over the years, people I've met have often asked me what I'm working on, and I've usually replied that the main thing was a book about Dresden. I said that to Harrison Starr, the movie maker, one time, and he raised his eyebrows and inquired, "Is it an anti-war book?" "Yes," I said, "I guess." You know what I say to people when I hear they're writing anti-war books? "No. What do you say, Harrison Starr?" I say, "Why don't you write an anti-glacier book instead?" What he meant, of course, was that there would always be wars, that they were as easy to stop as glaciers. I believe that, too. And even if wars didn't keep coming like glaciers, there would still be plain old death. When I was somewhat younger, working on my famous Dresden book, I asked an old war buddy named Bernard V. O'Hare if I could come to see him. He was a district attorney in Pennsylvania. I was a writer on Cape Cod. We had been privates in the war, infantry scouts. We had never expected to make any money after the war, but we were doing quite well. I had the Bell Telephone Company find him for me. They are wonderful that way. I have this disease late at night sometimes involving alcohol and the telephone. I get drunk, and I drive my wife away with a breath like mustard gas and roses, and then, speaking gravely and elegantly into the telephone, I ask the telephone operators to connect me with this friend or that one from whom I have not heard in years. I got O'Hare on the line in this way. He is short and I am tall. We were Mutt and Jeff in the war. We were captured together in the war. I told him who I was on the telephone. He had no trouble believing it. He was up. He was reading. Everybody else in his house was asleep. "Listen," I said, "I'm writing this book about Dresden. I'd like some help remembering stuff. I wonder if I could come down and see you and we could drink and talk and remember." He was unenthusiastic. He said he couldn't remember much. He told me, though, to come ahead. "I think the climax of the book will be the execution of poor old Edgar Derby," I said. "The irony is so great. A whole city gets burned down and thousands of people are killed. And then this one American foot soldier is arrested in the ruins for taking a teapot. And he's given a regular trial and then he's shot by a firing squad." Said O'Hare. "Don't you think that's really where the climax should come?" "I don't know anything about it," he said. "That's your trade, not mine." As a trafficker in climaxes and thrills and characterization and wonderful dialogue and suspense and confrontations, I had outlined the Dresden story many times. The best outline I ever made, or anyway the prettiest one, was on the back of a roll of wallpaper.
That was Slaughterhouse-Five by Kurt Vonnegut. Readers, I bet like me you are amazed and so disheartened at books so important to our popular culture that have been on the banned books list. Remember Fahrenheit 451? Reading is such an important part of our lives, we have to be aware of censorship. Thanks so much for joining us today. And see you back here next week on The Book Report.